Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
Well, good evening. We are in Zechariah 5 this evening. Let's review the ground rules. Zechariah is writing in order to encourage the Jews who have returned back to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity, in order to get them to finish the building of the temple. Most of the early part of the book so far has been encouragement. The visions that Zechariah has seen predict long-term outcomes for Jerusalem, demonstrating that Yahweh has not abandoned Israel or the Jews, but that he is in their efforts and he does expect that they are going to finish the work, and in fact proclaims in advance that the work is going to be finished, which would be a great deal of encouragement to the folks who were there leading that effort. Starting in chapter 5, the visions take a little bit of a turn into judgment. This again is encouragement to the Jews because it is not only God is with you, but it is also God is going to judge your enemies. Those who have oppressed you are going to have to pay a price for oppressing you. Now, these are a couple of very short visions, and they are filled with images that just beg for interpretation. But the basic rule that I laid out at the beginning that I'm going to try to continue to adhere to is that nobody knows more about what Zechariah saw than Zechariah does. He wrote down exactly what he saw, and if there was no angel to tell us what the interpretation of those things are, then we have to be really careful that we don't start allegorizing like mad. I have been reading lots of commentaries this week to try to dig deeper into chapter 5 and 6, and there is just no agreement on what these various things mean between the different commentators, because they are all just starting with the information we have on the page, which is the same information all of us have, and then they are interpreting it according to their desired outcome. So I'm going to try to avoid that kind of allegorization, and we're going to concentrate, like always, on context. Not just the immediate language context, but the historical context, remembering that the outcome of each of these visions has to be an encouragement to the Jews to finish the building of the temple. And then contextually, everything else that the prophets say, so that Zechariah fits into the general mold and the general outcome of the other prophets. That's what I mean when I say context, and hopefully that will keep us from becoming too wild in our interpretation. And when we run across things that I don't know, I'm just going to say, I don't know. This is what Zechariah saw, and we'll do our best to fit it into the appropriate context. All right, so there's the ground rules once again. Because the first thing that Zechariah is going to see here in chapter 5 is a scroll, but it appears to be an open scroll, laid out flat, almost like Aladdin's carpet. He's going to see it flying through the sky. And it has writing on both sides of it. And the writing is language of judgment and curse against the people who are breaking the law of God, whether that is within Judah or whether that is the larger Gentile community that have oppressed Judah. They are guilty of two particular things. Don't lie, don't swear falsely, don't steal. Now, you would think that if he was going to send a curse out onto the earth for a particular sin, that you could think of ostensibly much worse sins. But he only mentions these two. Now, the interesting thing about these two, as some commentators have pointed out, and I'm not certain about the significance of it, except that it does exist. If you're thinking about the Ten Commandments, and they are on two tablets of stone, and if you have five commandments on each of the two stones, if you have one, two, three, four, and five on a stone, the third one is, you won't take the Lord's name in vain, which is what swearing in God's name is, using it as a form of security or vanity for your own language, your own lies. If you look at the second tablet, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, number 8 is that you don't steal. Now, I find this really, really interesting because that may be God's way of saying the whole of the covenant I have made with you through the Ten Commandments, the entirety of everything that's written on those stones is being summarized in these two, God and man. Don't swear by God's name. Don't steal from each other. Be honest with each other. Now, I don't know if we can stretch Zechariah's point all the way to that, but it's an interesting reality that in the center of each of those stones, you would have found these two commands. So Zechariah starts, "Then I lifted up my eyes again, and I looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' And I answered, 'I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits, and its width is 10 cubits.' Then he said to me, 'This is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land.'" The word that is translated land there is a Hebrew word that can mean the whole earth. It is a standard that God is laying out for all the people to be held accountable by. Therefore, it is a curse to people. And it starts with, "Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on the one side." So one side of the scroll had God's command not to steal along with the curse that was attendant to that command. "And everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side." Verse 4 is going to make it clear that when he says swears, it's particular. It's swearing by God's name. Verse 4 says, "I will make it," this curse, this writing, "I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts." Again, important language. Zechariah keeps referring to Yahweh as the God of armies. That's going to become important in the second half of this chapter. The God of armies is going to make this command and this curse go forth, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name. In other words, there's no place to hide. God knows, God being omniscient and omnipresent. God knows where the liars are, and he knows where the cursers are, and he knows where the people are that take his name in vain and the people who swear falsely by his name. "And it," that curse, "will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timber and its stones." It's going to take down your house, your behavior before God, your stealing, your behavior against men. That is all the enterprise, the works, the activity of evil men, and that evil will ultimately consume your house and all that you have built. That's it. That's as much as we get for that vision. I have attempted to at least make sense of it within its context, Because the context would be, here is encouragement for the Jews to continue and finish the building of the temple. And just know that God knows that your enemies, particularly Babylon, will ultimately pay a price, which is going to become even more prominent in the next chapter when God says that he's going to remove the wickedness from the Jews and cast it all into Babylon, giving you some greater sense of why there's so much said about Babylon in the book of Revelation. But that's the entirety of the vision. What we know is God is very big on honesty, and he is very big on let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't swear by things that don't belong to you, especially don't swear by the name of God, because he said, first commandment, you will have no other God before me. And then he is very zealous for his name, as the third commandment says. And then when Jesus is here on the planet, he says that when you pray, you identify the God you're talking about, and you start with, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your name is separate from us. Your name is higher than us, more holy than us, and therefore we're not supposed to use it for our own vain reasons. It is hallowed. It is sanctified. And we are not to use it for any common purpose. So God says, do not swear by my name, especially if you're swearing falsely, especially if you're lying and using my name to give credibility to your lies, and don't steal from each other. And there is a curse attached to it that is going to fall on everybody who continues to break God's law. He knows, and he's going to punish accordingly. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see what this is going forth. I said, what is it? And he said, this is the ephah going forth. An ephah is like a basket, a measuring basket. It could be anywhere from 5 up to 10 gallons. Usually it was something that you would have in the market or in your home to put grain in, and you always had a lid on it in order to protect it from bugs or the wind or whatever else. This one also has a lid on it, but there was an ephah that was going forth. That means it was moving. It was going forth, and again he said, this is the appearance in all the land, and behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the ephah. Now, the same way that the scroll was oversized, we can assume that this ephah was oversized because there was a woman inside it. The angel is going to identify this woman as being the very personification of wickedness. And women, before you get too upset about the fact that the Bible has a woman being the personification of wickedness, it is also women who are going to remove it. So there, do you feel better about yourselves? A little something to encourage you there. I said, what is it? And he said, this is the ephah going forth. And again he said, this is their appearance in all the land, and behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the ephah. And he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down into the middle of the ephah and cast the lead weight on its opening. So she is now trapped inside this ephah. He opened it long enough for Zechariah to see that wickedness, the personification of wickedness, is what is going on inside this basket. But she is trapped inside it by this lead weight that is on top of it. And then I lifted up my eyes and I looked, and there two women were coming out with the wind in their wings. And they had wings like the wings of a stork. Very broad, very wide wings. And they lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heavens. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the ephah? And then he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar, that's Babylon. And when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. In other words, God is saying to the people who are building his temple, I know there is all this wicked worship going on in Babylon. And you were there for 70 years, and so you have adopted a lot of that, and you have brought it with you here to my temple. But I'm going to extricate that out of you. I'm going to put a lid on it, and I'm going to take it back where it belongs, back to Babylon. As I said a moment ago, never underestimate the language of Babylon that we saw in the book of Revelation. And we talked about how Babylon, which starts with the Tower of Babel all the way back in the book of Genesis and continues all the way to the book of Revelation, in the entirety of the Bible, you see language concerning Babylon as more than just a city. The city itself ultimately fell, not to be built again. But the concept of Babylon and the worship that comes from Babylon, particularly goddess worship and mystery religion that still pervades our world, has its roots in Babylon. If you saw, I'm going to be the only preacher this week to mention Katy Perry. If you saw Katy Perry recently, after she got back from her 11-minute ride into space, did you see her when she got back? She kissed the ground and then said that she had gotten in touch with the divine feminine. Okay, now we don't know what that means, except that, and the only reason I bring it up is because this idea of goddess worship is alive and well today. And again, it has its start in Babylonish mystery religion and has very much influenced the Catholic Church and its approach to Mary. So God says here, I'm going to take this wickedness, this goddess worship, this embodiment of mystery religion that you have naturally brought with you after 70 years in Babylon, and you've brought it here, but to build my temple, you'll have no other gods before me, and I am going to take her out of the land of Israel, out of the land of Judah. I'm going to take her back to Babylon where she belongs, where, according to the book of Revelation, she will continue to reside. Think of all the scarlet woman riding on the dragon language that we saw and its affiliation, its association with Babylon. So ultimately, when Jesus sets up his kingdom, when the new heavens and the new earth finally come, when the new Jerusalem comes down, God is finally going to take out everything that offends, everything that is evil, and all liars and all fornicators and everyone who sins against him are going to be utterly eliminated. He's sort of foreshadowing that here in saying that he is ultimately going to drive all evil religion out of Judah back to where it belongs. That's my understanding of what it says. Now, what it says is there was an ephah with a woman in it and a lead cover, and two other women with wings like storks took it out of Judah. And when Zechariah asks, where are they taking it? He said, back to Babylon, back to the land of Shinar. And notice that when wickedness goes to Babylon, they set up a temple for it. They build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. And then when the temple's prepared, they're going to put her on a pedestal. I think we see that going on a lot in the world today. The enshrining of wickedness, the bowing down to wickedness that continues to this very day, which the Bible calls Babylon. And that's chapter 5. Any questions about chapter 5 so far? I mean, I'm sure you have lots of questions.
I was going to say lots, but I think we have answers for
them. Yeah. At least I want you to be familiar with what Zechariah saw. And like I said, if you want to be entertained, go on the internet and look up Zechariah 5 commentaries, because people have some pretty wild interpretations. But now, continuing this theme of judgment, we go into chapter 6. And once we finish chapter 6, the initial visions at the beginning of Zechariah have come to their close, and then we'll begin to see a little more narrative going on. But chapter 6 says, "Now I lifted up my eyes again, and I looked, and behold, four chariots." These four horsemen that we saw earlier in Zechariah are now connected to chariots. The colors of the horses and the fact that they are chariots, I think, is a demonstration of the fact that God is the God of hosts, the God of armies. And he is sending out his armies into the earth to accomplish his sovereign will. "Behold, four chariots were coming forth from between the two mountains." There's a lot of speculation about which two mountains because of the word "the." But then again, earlier we saw Zechariah use the word "the" when talking about there was the ephah going forth. And we can't relate that to any earthly ephah that we're aware of. And so I think he's simply saying that there were these two mountains, and the mountains were of bronze. Bronze throughout the Bible speaks of judgment, speaks of righteousness. In the beginning of the book of Revelation, Jesus is described as having feet of bronze. And so there are these two mountains, and mountains are symbolic throughout Daniel and into Revelation and here in Zechariah of kingdoms. Kingdoms of the earth, but then the ultimate kingdom, the stone kingdom to come, that's going to destroy all of the kingdoms of the earth, grind them to powder until they blow away. So these bronze mountains probably are speaking of God's kingdom of perfect righteousness and judgment. And then the God of armies is sending out four chariots. With the first chariot were red horses. With the second chariot, black horses. With the third chariot, white horses. And with the fourth chariot, strong dappled horses. When we ran into these horses earlier in the book of Zechariah, we compared them to the horses that we found in the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, those colors are given correlations. The red horse is symbolic of war. The black horse is symbolic of famine and death and the results of war. The white horse is a sign of righteousness, peace. So that's interesting to note because of where these particular horses each go. "I spoke with the angel," says verse 4, "who was speaking with me. And I said, 'What are these, my Lord?' The angel replied to me, 'These are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth.'" That's very similar language to what we saw earlier in Zechariah. That these four horses represent the Spirit of God that goes out into the four corners of the earth, toward the four winds, toward the four directions of the compass, that they see the entirety of the earth, and then they report back to God what's going on the earth. We saw that earlier. "These are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country." Whenever Babylon attacked Judah, they would always come down from the north. That was the most convenient path for the armies from Babylon.
this reference to the North Country is probably a reference to Babylon, the very nation that had held these people in captivity for 70 years, and that God himself was sending war to Babylon in order to accomplish his righteous judgment, which actually happened. If you know the book of Daniel, if you know the history of the Middle East, you know that Babylon was conquered by the Medo-Persians. And then ultimately, the Medo-Persians are conquered by the Greeks. But when the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon, their king Cyrus was the very king who allowed the Jews to come back to rebuild the temple and rebuild the walls. So there was a time of relative peace between Jerusalem and Babylon. And that's what happens next, according to these horses, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white one goes forth after them, while the dappled ones go forth to the south country. That would be Egypt. Remember, we're talking about Jerusalem as the center. So they're going down to Egypt, who also had oppressed the children of Israel previously. And God sends the black horse up to Babylon, and then, having conquered it, sends the white horse and brings about peace and stability in that area. And that's exactly what happened historically, but here God takes credit for all of it, that he is the sovereign who brought about all of these events, which again would be very encouraging to the Jews in Jerusalem rebuilding the temple to know that their God Yahweh is defending them, is fighting for them, and is the very God who brought the Medo-Persians. Even though he is the God of armies, his army consisted of the Medo-Persians at that moment, because he can use any nation in the world to accomplish his ultimate will, and that he sent the Medo-Persians to deliver ultimately the Jews so that they could come back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple of God where the worship of God would continue. Absolute sovereignty. The angel replied to me, "These are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white ones go forth after them, while the dappled ones go forth to the south country. When the strong ones went out," this is a reference to those chariots, they are the strong ones, "when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go patrol the earth. And he said, 'Go patrol the earth.'" That means more than just go and look at it. Put it in order. Go take command of it. Go accomplish my will on the earth. So they patrolled the earth. "Then he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, 'See, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north.'" How did they accomplish that? They were his army. They were the Medo-Persians going and conquering Babylon and ultimately bringing about the deliverance of the Jews so they could go rebuild Yahweh's temple. And that appeased the wrath of God. "See, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. And the word of Yahweh also came to me, saying, 'Take an offering from the exiles, from Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah, and you go the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon.'" Now, was God just saying, "Go take an offering"? No, he had a specific reason for this offering to be taken up. It was in order to crown Joshua. And this is the only place, this is just so fascinating to me. Throughout the Bible, throughout the Old Testament, the offices of prophet, priest, and king were all individual offices, separate offices. It is only Jesus Christ who was ever fully prophet, priest, and king. And yet there is this foreshadow coming up. Listen to this language. Take silver and gold. That's the offering that you take from those who have just come from Babylon. When they've arrived from Babylon, they're going to have silver and gold on them. Take silver and gold and make an ornate crown. Oh, not just a regular crown. Make a fancy crown and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then say to him, thus says the God of armies, Yahweh of hosts, behold, in other words, look at him, a man whose name is Branch. Where else do we see this language of a branch coming out of Jesse's root? It's the language leading to Christ. And yet he is calling Joshua, behold, a man who is a branch. For he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of Yahweh. Again, remember the purpose of these visions, to encourage the people to return to the work and complete the temple. We saw previously that the governor, Zerubbabel, was told that he was going to be the one who was going to lay the plumb line, he was going to lay the capstone, he was going to start the work, and he was going to finish the work. Now Joshua, as the high priest, is being told that he is the one who is going to build the temple of God. In other words, you really should start this work because God is for you, he is against your enemies, he is cleansing you, he is sanctifying you, he is taking away your false worship, he is returning you to himself, and he is even giving you an intercessor, a high priest, and he is giving you a governor so that you are organized in the effort, and you will do it. You will accomplish it. Zerubbabel and Joshua are the ones who are going to live long enough to completely accomplish the rebuilding of my temple. Behold, a man whose name is Branch or Sprout. The Hebrew word can be a sprout. For he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of Yahweh. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on his throne. He'll be a priest acting like a king. And the council of peace will be between those two offices. Before, if anybody attempted to do the activity of an office that they were not assigned to, God would punish them. But here he says there's going to be peace between these two offices because I'm the one that's ordaining it, because he himself is a forerunner of Christ. He is a type, a shadow of Christ, who is the one who is going to build the ultimate temple of God, that this is all a foreshadow of, and he is going to accomplish my good will. He is ultimately going to drive out all of the evil, all of the wickedness, all of the worship of other gods. He's going to drive all of that out of my people, my kingdom, my ultimate new Jerusalem. It's all going to wrap up in Christ, and God is foreshadowing that by making Joshua a king priest. He's going to rule. He's going to sit on his throne. He will be a priest on his throne. And the council of peace will be between those two offices. And now the crown will become a reminder in the temple of the Lord to Helam, to Tobijah, to Jediah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. Those who are afar off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you will know, says Zechariah, then you will know when it's completed When it's all done, then you're going to know that the Lord of hosts sent me to you. And it will take place if you completely obey the Lord your God. And that's the final of these visions of the first six chapters. As I said, starting in verse 7, we'll get into more narrative and more story. There are still prophecies to come, but now we're going to find out a little bit more about Zechariah and his interactions with the people. So what we've seen in the first six chapters, if I can just give you a summary and an overview, what we've seen is a series of visions where God has guaranteed that the temple is going to be completed. But in the process, he has told his people that he is going to be with them. He is going to protect them. He is going to give them the wherewithal to complete the job. He has told them who their leaders are going to be, Zerubbabel and Joshua. He has given both Zerubbabel and Joshua guarantees that they are going to complete the temple. He has given them appropriate leadership, and the same way that the priests and the king were both under the law of God in order to dispense judgment righteously, he has combined these offices of priest and king to accomplish that among the people. He has foreshadowed the ultimate king, the ultimate prophet, the ultimate priest, Christ, and the guarantee long term that Jerusalem is not just going to be a temporary thing, but the temple and Jerusalem themselves speak of the future that God has guaranteed Israel in their regathering, in their rebuilding, and then ultimately New Jerusalem and the ultimate worship of God. So these visions should have been to the people a tremendous encouragement to know that the same God that was for them knew about their enemies, was going to judge their enemies, and was going to accomplish all his good will, perfectly in league with what we have seen of the God of the Bible all the way through. He's still on his throne, accomplishing whatever seems good to him. He might accomplish it through armies. He might accomplish it through horses and watchers and those who report back to him. But ultimately, he's in charge of it all because the name that Zechariah keeps using is the God of armies, the Lord of hosts, the one who's in charge of everything. And that's why he can tell people, get to work. The God who's in charge of everything wants this to happen and will accomplish it through you. So that's the first six chapters of Zechariah. That was fun. Questions, comments, interpretive dance. Anything? Okay.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.